You're listening to Aperitivo, first broadcast on the 19th of September 2013 on Monocle 24. Aperitivo, brought to you by The Glenlivet. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Aperitivo, coming to you live from Midori House and just down the road from the Monocle Cafe. I am Markus Hippi. On today's show...
First of all, the sarin gas called the kitchen gas. You know why? Because anyone can make sarin in his house.
They said it's very high quality, higher quality than even used in Iraq by Saddam Hussein.
Bashar al-Assad is making the media rounds. Shashank Joshi and Brett Mason discuss how presidents and dictators use, misuse and manipulate the media. Then, as Iran's leader heads to New York, we ask if Rouhani can save his country's relationship with the West.
I don't think Iran will ever do a North Korea and withdraw from the NPT and just build a bomb, because then they truly will become a rogue state, and Iran's not North Korea.
And as with every day on Aperitivo, we'll stop by the Monocle Cafe for coffee and a chat. Today, writer Damien Barr gives us a rundown on his travel style.
I'm here today with a suitcase, an umbrella and a small tweed bag. And that's how I am at the minute. I'm very mobile. When you're really mobile, you learn what's actually important to you. The first thing I always pack is a really good book.
All that plus music, a look ahead to the rest of the day's shows and much more. That is Aperitivo with me, Markus Hippi, right now on Monocle 24. So, lots coming up in the next hour here on Aperitivo, but before all that, here is Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news.
The Russian President Vladimir Putin said today he could not be 100% certain that a plan for the destruction of Syrian chemical weapons would be carried out successfully, but he saw reason to hope it would. The Syrian President Bashar al-Assad had previously said that he was committed to destroying his country's chemical weapons, but he warned it will take a year to do so. He again denied claims his forces were behind last month's chemical attack near Damascus, in which hundreds of people had died. Meanwhile, the United Nations is defending its report into the attack after criticism from Russia. The Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Yabkov said the UN didn't pay enough attention to evidence provided by the Syrian government.
Those experts, as we all know, departed Syria several days ago, and this evidence is with them, and we are disappointed that there is no due attention paid to this evidence in the report which the group presented in New York earlier this week.
The Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif has met with United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon today. The Iranian President Hassan Rouhani is scheduled to speak to the General Assembly next Tuesday. Recently, the Iranian government has hinted at a new willingness at the highest level to explore a compromise solution to Tehran's nuclear row with the West. The mother of the man who killed 12 people in a shooting at a Navy base in Washington, D.C. on Monday has said her heart is broken.
Aaron is now in a place where he can no longer do harm to anyone, and for that I am glad. To the families of the victims, I am so, so very sorry that this has happened. My heart is broken.
Kathleen Alexis was speaking as officials in Washington promised to investigate reports that an armed tactical response unit was ordered away from the scene of the shooting. Libya's former spy chief Abdullah al-Sanusi appeared in court in Tripoli on charges mostly related to crimes committed during the 2011 uprising. Also in the dock were around 30 other officials from the government of the former leader Muammar Gaddafi, including two former prime ministers, as well as former deputy foreign minister Abdelati Labidi. Sanusi, notorious as right-hand man to the slain Gaddafi, is wanted by the International Criminal Court on charges of ordering brutal reprisals during the uprising that toppled the Libyan strongman in 2011. Investigators are trying to establish the cause of a collision between a bus and train in the Canadian capital Ottawa. Six people died and 30 others were injured in the rush hour collision. Jean Laporte is from Ottawa's Transportation Safety Board.
First, we're documenting, photographing the wreckage and the accident site. We are assessing, we will be assessing the crossing, its design, and the sight lines. We'll be checking the warning systems and the gates at the crossing to ensure they were functioning correctly.
And financial news now. The US shares closed at record highs after the Federal Reserve ruled out an early end to its economic stimulus package. Reports had suggested the program would be scaled back, but the Fed chairman, Ben Bernanke, says it's not the right time.
In evaluating whether a modest reduction in the pace of asset purchases would be appropriate at this meeting, however, the committee concluded that the economic data do not yet provide sufficient confirmation of its baseline outlook to warrant such a reduction.
And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
That was Jonathan Wheatley. Thank you very much. And Jonathan will be back with even more news headlines in about 24, 25 minutes. You're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. We are back right after this.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo to Buenos Aires
to Zurich to Hong Kong
to Toronto
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Aperitivo. The time is 2.06 a.m. in Tokyo. It is 18.06 here in London, and it is 13.06 in New York City. It is time now for us to take a fresh look at the top stories around the world today. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Shashank Joshi, Research Fellow at RUSI here in London, and Brett Mason, Europe Correspondent for SBS World News Australia. Welcome both to the programme.
Evening. Hello there.
Thank you for coming in. Now, today we are looking at the media and how world leaders use and misuse it. On Tuesday, former American Congressman Denis Kucinich and Fox News senior foreign affairs correspondent Greg Palkett spoke with Bashar al-Assad, Syria's president in Damascus. It was part of a special that aired yesterday evening on that news network. The interview was apparently shot by a Syrian camera crew and was conducted with no restrictions on the questions that could be asked. It is all part of a media blitz that usually camera-shy Assad has been on lately. We know that Assad doesn't do many audio interviews. He is known to be self-conscious about his voice and some of his mannerisms. What is also interesting is that the Syrian government posted the interview themselves. It is on YouTube, and we will soon hear a clip about that. This is from Assad's own people with their serious music at the beginning, and then Denis Kucinich.
Hello, Mr. President. Thank you very much for providing Fox News with this opportunity for an interview. I'm joined here by my colleague, reporter Greg Palkott, and we're very interested in proceeding. As you know, there's been a number of breaking news stories which we need to discuss with you. The UN has just released its chemical weapon report. My colleague, Greg Palkott, will be discussing that with you in a moment. I want to talk to you about other major developments regarding the chemical weapons plan, which has been agreed to by the U.S. and the Russian government. Do you agree with this plan to secure and to eventually destroy the chemical weapons?
Last week, we joined the international agreement of preventing the WMD, chemical WMD. And part of this agreement, the main part, is to not to manufacture these armaments, not to store, and not to use, and of course not to distribute. And part of it is to get rid of those materials, the chemical materials. So of course when we are part now of this agreement, we have to agree on that chapter.
So that was Bashar al-Assad with Denis Kucinich, and it went on like that for a half hour. It wasn't all polite. They actually got into it a bit. Here is Greg Palkott.
While the UN inspectors did not lay blame, that is, they did not place culpability for the attack, there are many experts interpreting this report, some that I've spoken to in the last 12 hours, that frankly say this attack looks firmly like an attack coming from your government, from the Syrian government. Hmm. They point to a few things. They say it was a large amount of gas, sarin gas, maybe as much as a ton. The rebels could not have had that. They say the type of rocket, an M14 artillery, a 330 millimeter, never used by the rebels before, that they needed large vehicles to send these rockets up. The rebels don't have that. And maybe most importantly, they point to the trajectory of the rockets. They say that they were able to trace the rockets back from the impact point to where they came from. And in two different occasions, this is according to the UN, they say that the start point was Quezon Mountain, the headquarters of the Republican Guard. What do you say to that?
Everything you mentioned is part of the report.
Excuse me, sir?
Everything you mentioned, all these points, are part of the report?
These points are all part of the report. These are all facts.
No, the report didn't mention anything regarding the Republican Guards or things like this.
They said they gave the azimuth tracking of the trajectory, and people have extrapolated from the azimuth track that that is where it was coming from, northwestern Damascus. Yeah.
First of all, the sarin gas called the kitchen gas. Do you know why? Because anyone can make sarin in his house.
They said it's very high quality, higher quality than even used in Iraq by Saddam Hussein, your neighbor at the time.
First of all, any rebel can make sarin. Second, we know that all those rebels are supported by governments. So any government that would have such chemical material can hand it over.
The experts say that they've tracked nothing like this. It's a ton of sarin gas. It is launchers. It is rockets. It's a whole fleet, which happened to be, from time to time, those kinds of armaments, those kind of munitions, happen to be in your bases.
No. This is realistically cannot be possible.
That was President Assad being confronted by Greg Palkett. So clearly this doesn't look very good for Assad. Shashank Joshi, why do you think they posted this?
Well, first of all, he probably feels a burst of confidence. He wants to show himself in the media having escaped strikes, to show he's alive, to show he's well, to show he's defiant, and to show that Russia has, in a sense, given him a new lease of life. But I think he's also muddying the waters and lowering expectations. In the same interview, he said it would cost $1 billion to get rid of his chemical weapons, and he said it would take over a year. In other words, he defied the deadline agreed by the Russians and the Americans of the middle of next year, and said, look, if the Americans want to take our chemical weapons, take their poison gas, put it on their soil, that's fine by us. And I think what he's doing is setting expectations so low that when the inevitable foot dragging or cheating occurs, he can say, I told you it would take this long. I told you right at the beginning, I said yes, but I gave you some qualifications, so you can't bomb me now.
Brett Mason, Europe correspondent for SBS World News Australia. What is your impression? Do you think idea for this interview or these interviews even has come from the president himself or his circle of media advisors?
Well, it certainly shows a renewed confidence from the Syrian regime. When these strikes were first talked about, when this attack took place, many people didn't even know whether the president was alive. That's how long it had been since he had engaged with Western media. So for him to be doing what is effectively a media blitz shows the confidence within the regime, but it also shows how important these interviews are. It's that old saying that it's not necessarily what's said, it's the fact that something is being said. And for him to engage with Western journalists from organisations like Fox News is really quite extraordinary. So from the perspective of what's said, that's not so much important. It's the fact that he can say, well, I'm inviting Western media in. And interestingly, after having been reporting from the border for some time over the last few weeks, it's been impossible for journalists like me to get into Syria in the lead-up. Now the government is handing out visas like candy. They're very keen for Western journalists to be in there having this dialogue.
And can I say one more thing? He's not ranting or raving. This isn't Gaddafi saying it's al-Qaeda who put drugs in the instant coffee of the rebels. What he's saying is, of course, flatly false and ludicrous, but it sounds reasonable, and therefore it reinforces the beliefs of his supporters and those in large parts of the world, by the way. We forget, not everyone believes what we believe here in the West, that in fact this could have been the rebels.
So were you anyway surprised by the fact that interviewers were actually allowed to ask questions completely freely?
well, they were allowed to ask them and there was no pressure on him to answer them. And we've heard that in the excerpt we just heard there, where they were free to ask as many questions as they liked. But it's also that fine line when you're a foreign journalist in a country, effectively the guest of a government or a president, it's very difficult to operate entirely freely. It may be a in principle agreement, but you're still sitting in a room and the camera operator is a Syrian camera person. You've got government minders no doubt following you around. And even colleagues of mine who are there who have these visas and have permission to be there are finding it very difficult to break away from these controlled sit-down. The build-up behind that interview would have been extraordinary. It would have been a very tightly controlled process. And as you just said, it was designed to present a calm and measured response to these quite aggressive questions from the West.
But it is worth noting, of course, one of the interviewers was Denis Kucinich, who is not some experienced veteran journalist. He is America's George Galloway, right? He's a man who met Assad a number of times, was sympathetic to his regime, and has been embarrassed off the scene recently. But he's not some sort of, you know, hard-hitting veteran Paxman-style figure.
So is it more about the message that was delivered? Because when we were listening to those excerpts earlier, it became quite obvious that it was partly about language skills, partly about maybe not having confidence as a performer. But Al-Assad didn't seem to do that well in terms of performance.
I'd give him reasonable points, actually. I thought his English is impressive. His tone was calm. And I referenced Gaddafi earlier. You could take other examples. Even Mubarak or Mohamed Morsi. Mm-hmm. He is a calm man. Why should we be surprised? He's a British-trained medical professional. He's lived in this country. I thought his English was okay. And I thought his answers were actually quite intelligent, asking the journalist, were all of those things in the report, he asked. The truth, of course, is they weren't. They were extrapolated. And the minute he said that, Assad, I think, scored a few points.
And when we are talking about examples of world leaders or politicians using media, another example of that recently has been Russian President Putin's writing on New York Times. Here is a sample of it.
It is alarming that military intervention in internal conflicts in foreign countries has become commonplace for the United States. Is it in America's long-term interest? I doubt it. Millions around the world increasingly see America not as a model of democracy, but relying solely on brute force, cobbling coalitions together under the slogan, you're either with us or against us. My working and personal relationship with President Obama is marked by growing trust. I appreciate this. I carefully studied his address to the nation on Tuesday, and I would rather disagree with a case he made on American exceptionalism, stating that the United States' policy is what makes America different. It's what makes us exceptional. It is extremely dangerous to encourage people to see themselves as exceptional, whatever the motivation. There are big countries and small countries, rich and poor, those with long democratic traditions, and those still finding their way to democracy. Their policies differ, too. We are all different. But when we ask for the Lord's blessings, we must not forget that God created us equal.
That was an excerpt of President Putin's piece in New York Times. Putin actually got a reply when U.S. Senator John McCain wrote in a similar way to Russian Pravda. Here is a taster.
A Russian citizen cannot publish a testament like the one I just offered. President Putin and his associates do not believe in these values. They don't respect your dignity or accept your authority over them. They punish dissent and imprison opponents. They rig your elections. They control your media. They harass, threaten, and banish organizations that defend your right to self-governance. To perpetrate their power, they foster rampant corruption in your courts and your economy, and terrorize and even assassinate journalists who try to expose their corruption. President Putin claims his purpose is to restore Russia to greatness at home and among the nations of the world. But by what measure has he restored your greatness? He has given you an economy that is based almost entirely on a few natural resources that will rise and fall with those commodities. Its riches will not last, and while they do, they will be mostly in the possession of the corrupt and powerful few. Capital is fleeing Russia, which, lacking rule of law and a broad-based economy, is considered too risky for investment and entrepreneurship. He has given you a political system that is sustained by corruption and repression and isn't strong enough to tolerate dissent.
When listening to these examples, I start to wonder what is in the air at the moment. Why is it that all of a sudden it seems that world leaders want to use media more in a different way?
Because they have to, and diplomacy now is instantaneous and it's 140 characters or less. We're seeing that the speeches that were delivered in the United States were seen in Damascus at the same time they were being seen in California, in Australia, in London. This is the world is getting smaller by the moment, and these leaders don't have to only convince their own people and supporters, they have to convince the world and to engage. I mean, when these speeches are happening, Twitter was just lighting up all around the world. People were instantaneously digesting and commenting on what was happening. There is so much pressure, and for these world leaders, they know that they need to engage on that level in order to get their message out there.
I think that's absolutely correct, but I'd add one other point, which is that in the West, at least, democratic opinion is exceptionally important when leaderships are uncertain. Look at Parliament rejecting and repudiating military action in Syria. Look at Congress essentially overturning, derailing Obama's plan to go to war. Putin's op-ed was exceptionally well-timed because he knew he was exploiting a point at which the American public were effectively on his side. And that's why he didn't speak in the same belligerent, hectoring tones of John McCain. He spoke in tones that appealed directly to those particular concerns of the American people.
How safe game is this for world leaders? Do you think this kind of media performances could do more harm to them than work in their benefit?
Well, of course, they hire very expensive Western PR firms to write many of these op-eds, so they know how to calibrate the message. It's when they go on without the appropriate media advisors that they can often mess up and make racist or aggressive or xenophobic comments. But Putin, of course, or Israeli leaders writing in the New York Times or other leaders, these guys have very expensive advisors to use the right language to appeal to precisely the right demographics. So the risks are fairly small if you use it appropriately.
But look at President Assad. Here is someone who has effectively had his reputation beyond tarnished by the US president, the most powerful person in the world, who sits down not once but several times with the US huge media organizations. They don't even land a blow, not a single blow. I mean, this is a big win in terms of the regime's outlook. I mean, this is how important these things are. Yes, there's absolutely a risk, but we've seen now 2-3 interviews lasting an hour or more, and not a single blow landed. I mean, it's quite extraordinary.
We have already touched this topic, but to conclude with, do you think Al-Assad's television interview and President Putin's and Senator McCain's newspaper writings have actually changed something?
I think Putin's intervention in the US debate was very intelligent. It was on 9/11, and therefore terrorism was in everyone's mind. It appealed to God, which I thought was a very nice touch on Putin's part. And most of all, I think it was very, very carefully written and quite respectful. And in that sense, I think it has reinforced President Obama's difficulties, absolutely. And I think Assad's interview, also reasonably moderate, will also contribute to the change in public opinion that is so skeptical of Western strategy on Syria today, both here and in the US.
Undeniably had an impact. I would agree with all of those points. And I think that when you look at the impact of those interviews where President Obama was effectively on the front foot, taking the lead, bringing the UK and France and Germany with him, and then all of that collapsing around him, and then having to effectively answer the accusations of you know, a long-standing rival is quite extraordinary to have witnessed, I think, and probably not what the president was expecting to happen.
Thank you very much. You're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24 with me, Markus Hippi. I'm joined here by Shashank Joshi from Russia and Brett Mason from SBS World News Australia. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll ask if Barack Obama will grab a slice of pizza with Iran's president next week. Stay tuned.
The Glenlivet was the first single malt to successfully cross the Atlantic Ocean. And since that first journey, the world-renowned whiskey has never looked back. Now, master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting their global community of whiskey connoisseurs, the guardians of the Glenlivet, to help create their next limited edition whiskey. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
Welcome back to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Shashank Joshi, Research Fellow at RUSI, and Brett Mason, Europe Correspondent for SBS World News Australia. We're going to stay slightly on track with the media, but we look now to Iran, whose President Rouhani himself gave a TV interview on an American network, NBC. Rouhani, who is widely seen as a moderate, said his country won't develop nuclear weapons. In recent weeks and months, he's made what seems to be a very conscious effort to reach a hand out to the West. He has alleged to have exchanged letters with Barack Obama. He has started using Twitter in a country where social media is banned. And he sent a fig leaf of sorts to the region's Jewish population. Next week, he is at the United Nations in New York and, may it seems, bump into Obama himself. So from our perch here in London and Europe, how is Iran's relationship with the West changing? A bit earlier we heard from David Patrikarakos, author of Nuclear Iran, The Birth of an Atomic State. Here is David's thoughts on Iran's alleged nuclear weapons program.
I actually think that they want to get all the way to the capability to build a nuclear bomb without necessarily having the bomb itself. That way you get all of the political gains, the deterrent factor and everything else without the political cost. I don't think Iran will ever do a North Korea and withdraw from the NPT and just build a bomb, because then they truly will become a rogue state. And Iran's not North Korea. It's not going to shut up shop, pull down the curtains and just isolate itself entirely. It wants more involvement in the international community, wants more involvement in the Middle East. And I think what they're looking for is some kind of way that they can get right to the brink of nuclear capability, derive some strength for that, but still stay just on the right line of things. That's what I think they're after.
That was author David Patrikarakos, and in the studio I'm with Shashank Joshi and Brett Mason. Hopes weren't that high when Iran got a new president. However, he seems to be surprisingly willing for cooperation. How surprised have you been by this?
I'm not awfully surprised. He said much of this during his campaign. He said he wanted to repair relations with the West. He said negotiation is about flexibility. In fact, not only he, but many of the other candidates rounded on Saeed Jalili, who was another candidate and, of course, the nuclear negotiator, for his perceived rigidity and inflexibility in the talks so far. So this was in the air. What I would say is it's not just about what Rouhani is saying, important as that is. It's also what he's doing. He's transferred the nuclear file from the Security Council to the Foreign Ministry, which is now led by a reformist. And he's really making concrete steps, not just words.
How well do we know him now? And do we actually know where he draws the line when it comes to being friends with the West?
Well, that's what we're about to find out. I think we're going to see him on the world stage interacting with other world leaders and having to put those that talk into action. And that's where those principles are going to be put to the test. But I think people are encouraged by what's going on in Iran. And I think that what's happened with Syria and the United States, that the fact that President Obama has seemed willing to negotiate and talk about what's happening with chemical weapons, perhaps points to what may happen there in terms of nuclear weapons. Whether or not he's prepared to go that far, I would be deeply skeptical.
In the television interview, Rouhani said that he does have the power to make sure that Iran won't seek a nuclear bomb. Is he to be believed, considering how little power president in Iran actually has?
Well, it's changed over time. We shouldn't dismiss the powers of the president. Remember, the nuclear dispute took a turn for the worse in 2005 when President Ahmadinejad took charge and very promptly began to overturn earlier agreements that had ironically been reached by Rouhani himself. For example, he resumed enrichment. So the president does have power. Of course, Khamenei has veto power. We know that. But he exercises that veto with care. He tries to look which way the political wind is blowing before he shuts down certain avenues. And he has made very interesting statements in the past week saying he sees diplomacy as a form of heroism, of flexibility in diplomacy. So he's suggesting he's going to give Rouhani a chance. Rouhani is limited. He has hardliners around him. He can't change policy on Syria just like that, for example. But he does still have some power to change things.
So now that Rouhani seems to be very willing to do a conscious effort to reach a hand to the West, should President Obama reply somehow in similar fashion?
Well, I think he has to. I mean, if you look what's happened in the last 2 or 3 weeks, the pressure is really on the West to prove its credentials, to prove its willingness to negotiate and open dialogue with these countries. So I think that President Obama will have to. I mean, the pressure is on him. But how far those discussions go and whether he's prepared to open another box publicly like he did with Syria and put pressure on Iran is going to be interesting to see, because there is a huge risk involved for him. He's staking his credibility on what's going on. And a lot of people are saying that perhaps it's something that the American people don't really want to see, a forced involvement in the region. There seems to be an unwillingness to go anywhere near it at that point in time. And that really puts the pressure on Obama. How does he handle that for so many years, particularly in the last two or three? The pressure has been on Iran and these other countries. Now the pressure is on Obama to see how he diplomatically will handle this situation.
And he's already replied to Rouhani's letter, of course, which is a first positive sign in itself.
Exactly. But how much further beyond that we can go? I mean, it's a very difficult one, isn't it, for both leaders?
What do you think will happen next week at the UN?
I'm not sure they'll meet. I think there's expectation that will this be the first face-to-face meeting between an Iranian and American leader since Jimmy Carter met the Shah of Iran. And actually, I think that may be counterproductive, and both sides know it. If they meet, set expectations exceedingly high, and then nothing comes of it, it will be used as ammunition by hardliners on both sides, by the principalists, the old Ahmadinejad camp in Iran, and by the hardliners and the right wing in Congress in America. I think they want to let their officials hash this out first and set the stage for a historic face-to-face meeting at some point in the future, I think.
And what are your expectations at the moment? How much do you think the relations between Iran and the US could actually improve?
I think it'll be a very superficial improvement. I think it will be designed to present an image more so than any real action, because it's going to take a long time. These are very long-running issues, as we all know, and they're not going to be resolved over a slice of pizza at the United Nations in a face-to-face meeting. It's going to be a very long road to diplomacy between those two nations, and there is a lot of ground that isn't common, that there are issues that need to be fleshed out, and neither side is going to be willing to give too much. Sure, there's been this exchange of letters, which in itself is historic, but there's a long, long way to go, and the diplomacy is really going to take probably years to play out, I would suspect.
Yeah, and I would say one more thing, which is that this is a balancing act. The more the US opens up to Iran, the more the Gulf allies of the United States begin to worry. I was in Qatar yesterday, and you can see the concern amongst Emiratis, Saudis, Bahrainis, that the more US-Iran relations improve, that they can remember a time when the US was closer to Iran than it was to Saudi Arabia. They do not want to go back to such a period.
We'll have to leave it there, gentlemen. Shashank Joshi, Research Fellow at RUSI, and Brett Mason, Europe Correspondent for SBS World News Australia. Thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Ut London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come then in the second half hour of today's Aperitivo. We'll be heading to the Monocle Cafe to talk with Damien Barr, author of the memoir Maggie and Me. We'll also preview what's coming up on today's Globalist Asia and Monocle Daily. But before we get started on that, here is Jonathan Wheatley with the world news headlines.
Marcus, thanks very much. The Russian President Vladimir Putin said today that he could not be 100% certain that a plan for the destruction of Syrian chemical weapons would be carried out successfully, but he saw reason to hope it would. The Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif has met with the United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon today. Recently, the Iranian government has hinted at a new willingness at the highest level to explore a compromise solution to Tehran's nuclear row with the West. The mother of the man who killed 12 people in a shooting at a Navy base in Washington, D.C. on Monday has said her heart is broken. Kathleen Alexis was speaking as officials in Washington promised to investigate reports that an armed tactical response unit was ordered away from the scene of the shooting. And Libya's former spy chief Abdullah al-Sanusi appeared in court in Tripoli on charges mostly related to crimes committed during the 2011 uprising. Also in the dock were around 30 other officials from the government of former leader Muammar Gaddafi, including two former prime ministers. And that's the news from Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. Welcome back to Aperitivo Live here on Monocle 24. The time is 21:33 in Moscow. It is 18:33 here in London and 13:33 in Rio de Janeiro. Each day on Aperitivo, we leave the comfortable confines of Studio One here at Midori House to head down to the equally well-appointed Monocle Cafe on Chiltern Street here in London. On today's show, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco met writer Damien Barr at the cafe for a chat about his successful memoir called Maggie and Me. Coincidentally, the book was released at the same time as Margaret Thatcher's death. Fernando and Damien also discuss his other projects, such as Silent Cinema and Reading Weekend. Here is Fernando.
So I'm here with you, Damien, here at the cafe. So tell me, what are you drinking today?
This afternoon I'm having a sparkling mineral water because I know that tonight I'm going to a friend's book launch and it's going to get messy, and so I'm kind of laying the groundwork for my hangover tomorrow.
So we're doing the healthy choice today. I'm going for a green tea as well. But first, Damien, I would like to talk with you about the success of Maggie and Me. It's been everywhere and you've been traveling a lot, so you did a tour of the book as well, right?
The book tour has been kind of non-stop. I mean, it was published the week that Thatcher died, quite by coincidence. I had nothing to do with that. Nobody's publicist is that good. It's been out since I think just the end of April, and I've basically been on the road with it since then. So I've been all over the UK and abroad as well, to Canada. I did a book tour there, which was really interesting. They're an incredibly well-read country. All the journalists I spoke to had actually read the book cover to cover, even the TV journalists, which is so rare. And I'll be going to the States when it's published there next year, and hopefully also to Australia. Right now, I'm just going round and round the UK. I've been to all the major festivals, which has been great because they've all got different characters. You know, Hay is very different from Edinburgh, which again is very different from Cheltenham. So I'm loving it.
And it's interesting to notice as well that, in my opinion at least, it's not like a positive or negative impersonation of Thatcher. So it's just like your memoir and your views on her. So what are your views on her? They're not completely negative or positive.
I have a very complex view of her. And one of the things I wanted to do was just to tell my story, tell the story of what it was like growing up in the 80s in this very particular part of the west of Scotland, and to talk about the impact that her policies had. Now, the impact of those policies was largely negative, but there were some positive things about it. You know, her message, for example, about individuality, you can be your own person, it's more important where you're going than where you've come from. That got through to me at a very young age. The fact that she was a survivor, you know, she survived this assassination attempt by the IRA. She survived countless political assassination attempts. And that inspired me when I was facing, you know, really challenging circumstances, abusive circumstances. So, you know, I found her to be quite an exciting and interesting person. But looking back, I can, of course, see, you know, a lot of the negative things that she did as well. The deindustrialization, which put my dad out of a job. The privatization of utilities, which meant that, you know, some people made money from shares and people like us had very high bills that we couldn't afford to pay and so often were cold. So it's a very complicated picture. And when she died, I was kind of dismayed by the opinion from the left and the opinion from the right, which said that she was a hero or a monster. She could only be two, you know, those two things. The truth is, she was a hero and a monster.
Do you have plans for a new book already, or can you tell us something?
I am thinking about what I want to write next. There's now been enough time between finishing the last one and thinking about what I want to do. I mean, the truth is, as much as I love touring and talking to people about this book, it's fresh for the people who are reading it, and lots of them are, and that's lovely. But for me, I want to move on to something else. I want to write something else, and I don't yet know what that is.
Let's move on to another very fun project of yours, the Silent Cinema. I know you just finished one about fashion, right? Yes. Can you tell us how it was and maybe tell us about the next one?
So we just did a Silent Cinema partnership with St. Martin's Courtyard and the British Fashion Council, and we did three nights of outdoor cinema in central London in St. Martin's Courtyard, and we showed Zoolander, Grey Gardens and the September issue. And how it works basically is we have digital wireless headphones, and we've created this bit of technology whereby we can create cinema in just about any space. So we did the first ever cinema for Selfridges. We built a cinema in their car park, and we showed Halloween a few years ago. We've done it with Orange, we've done it with Hendrick's Gin, we've done it in all kinds of places, hotels, train stations, goods yards, you know, parks. It really makes people listen, which is something that we don't spend much time doing now. And it also means you don't have to listen to the person next to you crunching their popcorn or tweeting on their phone. We should have something coming up for Halloween in Glasgow, which is quite exciting, but I'm just waiting to confirm that.
And finally, I want to talk about Reading Weekend.
The Reading Weekends have been going for about 5 years, as has Silent Cinema, and the Reading Weekends grew out of my literary salon. So the literary salon is a sort of monthly or every 6 weeks, and it's a mixture of established and emerging authors always reading new material. So David Nicholls launched one day there, Diana Athill read her memoirs for the first time, Helen Fielding started the new Bridget Jones. So we, you know, we really have a range of tastes, and those happen mainly at Shoreditch House, but all kinds of other places. We have a salon coming up with the British Council in Istanbul in November. But from the salon, we realised that people have an appetite for doing stuff to do with books. You know, books are a part of our social life. And so we started these reading weekends. And basically, it's a weekend-long salon. So we take 12 to 18 guests to a really nice country house or hotel with a literary connection. And they spend time with the author. The author does readings, I do a salon. We also do bibliotherapy with the School of Life. So we have a bibliotherapist who comes and talks to you about where you're at in your life. You know, you're bored with your job or you want to end a relationship or something like that. And she prescribes fiction to help cure the ailments of your life. And we also have a very competitive Scrabble. And I read bedtime stories to people. So it's a really nice weekend. We have one coming up in Sussex in November with Rupert Thompson, who's fantastic. But if you want to check that out, it's just readingweekend.co.uk, I think.
And finally, Damien, I just want to ask, where are you based? Because you seem to travel everywhere.
Well, I'm here today with a suitcase, an umbrella, and a small tweed bag. And that's kind of, you know, how I am at the minute. I'm very mobile. I think when you're really mobile, you learn what's actually important to you. The first thing I always pack is a really good book. And then I have a really nice little old cashmere hoodie that I have for traveling. So, you know, I can sleep in it or I can snuggle up in it if I'm on a plane and the air conditioning gets cold. And I have earplugs, which never leave my side, because as much as I love listening to other people's conversations, sometimes it's just not that interesting. And so I travel with those, and usually with a hip flask as well, and always with sunglasses, not so much for the weather, but for early starts and hangovers.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for the tips and for the interview.
That was Damien Barr with Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco in the Monocle Cafe. Up next on this edition of Aperitivo, we get a taste of Swedish design. Stay tuned.
The Glenlivet is the original Speyside single malt whiskey, and since 1824, its flavour has defined the region. Join master distiller Alan Winchester to determine the future of this historic distillery. Three new whiskies will set sail around the world, and members of the Guardians of the Glenlivet are invited to decide which will become the Guardians chapter. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the Guardians of the Glenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
Welcome back to Aperitivo with me, Markus Hippi. During London Design Festival, the who's who in the world of design flocked to the exhibitions, shows and events across the UK capital. Aled John, the producer of our weekly design show Section D, is busy meeting many of them. Recently, he sat down with Martin Willers from the Swedish industrial design agency People People. Martin brought with him the Transparent Speaker, a beautiful new product designed and developed by People People. It's something that needs to be both heard and seen, which unfortunately isn't possible due to the confines of radio, but do Google it. Aled and Martin spoke in Studio 2 here at Midori House about design innovation and what goes into making visionary products.
People People was founded 4 years ago by four friends, myself, Per, Johan and Anna. We all studied in Umeå, a design school in North Sweden that was recently ranked the number one design school in the world. But they've done a career at Nokia, and they felt like we didn't really change the world there. So we started this company because we thought a lot of products lost perspective on what really matters to people. So that's why we're called People People, right? We start with people, and with that understanding, we can also end in products that are made for people. So yeah, we started, and after we had a few consultancy gigs, we wanted to sort of show more what we could do. So we started blogging, like kind of, you know, Google have a lab. We have our own little lab where we put like 20% of our time in making products that we would like to see hit the market.
You've got a really interesting array of products, which we'll talk about in a moment. But I'm interested about that idea. That's kind of your focus is to study the behavior of people, what they need to do, and then mix it with, you know, good design and good aesthetics.
That's exactly right. Take a water boiler. Actually, people constantly overfill it with water because they can't see how much water it is in the water boiler. So we made a water boiler where you can actually see that more easily, and it's smaller, more made for your morning coffee or tea, and you can actually control the temperature. If everyone in the UK would use that water boiler, we would save all the energy used for all the traffic lights in the UK. Yes, by the overfilling of water. So like these small things really matters. But when it comes to more like lifestyle products, for example, the speaker, we made a transparent speaker. Why is it transparent? It's because when couples move together in the city, right, people want to not have these spaceships of big boxes that, you know, typically is done by old men in dark rooms.
I was going to say, it sounds like you're describing my speaker at home, huge big black boxes.
But pretty much all our friends, they had to throw out the stereo when they moved together with the girlfriend because it's, you know, five surround sound cables everywhere. And it's a big no-no, right? Because today you don't have a car to show off who you are. You have a living room. And that space is really valuable to people. So we were like, how can we make something that sort of blends into the environment, but is iconic enough to sort of be a piece of art on your wall as well? And that's how we came up. We're like, let's make it transparent. So, you know, your wallpaper or your rest of your interior design sort of shines through, but let's make it big enough so you can have a sort of a party at home.
You've brought it in with us. This is the transparent speaker you're talking about.
Yeah.
It's very handsome. It's a transparent glass box, metal, black rim. Is that correct? And then, yeah, it would allow the speaker to kind of tell the story of the rest of the room, I guess. It's not going to take it up, but it in itself is a very handsome piece of design.
Yeah, you know, if you want to make something durable, you have to sort of go for something that really looks iconic to your eye. So really try to boil down to the essence of the speaker. So that's why we sort of, in this transparent box, you can still see the cables flowing. Like, that's actually how it looks like. We're not trying to hide reality, but at the same time, we really sort of make a lot of effort in making the speaker elements really look like the strong icon of a speaker element. So we put, like, when we had one manufacturer that couldn't do great sound and good looks, we had to change, and it delayed production 2.5 months. So being really like detail oriented and passionate about the details in this product.
Is there a side to this speaker that it could be quite delicate as well? You were explaining just before the interview, it's quite fun, the process you went through of finding out if it was durable enough.
Yeah, it's crazy, you know, when you're doing, like, we launched this product on the internet, so it's born global, so you have to certify it for all these different markets. And you won't believe, like, the tests you have to do. There's one test when you have, like, a big metal ball that's, like, 0.5 kilo, and you drop it 0.5 meter up in the air, down on the glass, and it has to take it. So, and there's another drop test where you just drop the product on the floor repeatedly, and, you know, imagine this being your baby, seeing someone, yeah, I got to test your baby, and you're just dropping it repeatedly when it's made out of glass.
How many times did you have to go through that process before you found the
actually
the
not that
quality?
Many, because acoustically we needed like quite thick glass to make it like this transparent sound that we were looking for. So actually the glass is like 6 millimeters thick, and it's like hardened and water cut, so actually the acoustic aspect made us go for quite sturdy glass. So yeah, we broke one or two, actually, but now they're super solid. And we're making them wall-mounted as well, so we just want people to be really confident that they're, like, solid and durable.
The impression I get of your brand, it's kind of fun. It's a solutions-based approach to, like you said, to common things that people, consumers will have to deal with, consumers that use speakers or they use pocket watches. And another thing that you brought in today, can you tell us about it?
Yeah, the pocket watches, it's interesting because, yeah, we're a bit all over the place where solutions can happen, because we start with people. We don't decide really what to do. And this was just, we noted that a lot of people don't have a wristwatch anymore as a function, because you have your smartphones and you keep time with something else. So we're like, what would make people actually want a watch? And one thing is, like, when there's some symbolic things when you look, you know, I have to go home. And one of the most interesting of those things was the three-piece suit kind of thing. And we could see there's a trend in going back to having more jackets.
Yeah.
So we're like, let's design a timepiece for that. And in this case, we're just, you know, we blog a lot of ideas, but this was really popular from the start. Like a lot of people got back to me like, I'm marrying tomorrow. Where can I get it? Panic. Because they want that. So once we have that like resonance with people, that's when we go ahead and make a real product out of it.
Do you tout your ideas to the public before you actually put them to implementation?
Yeah, it's totally open source.
So it's a real back and forth.
Yeah, and you know, people go like, how could you share your best ideas openly on the internet?
Yeah, the issue of patents and trademarks.
Well, yeah, well, you can apply for a design patent after you publish, and not a patent, but a pattern, like design protection. So yeah, of course we do that sort of stuff, but we get so much more benefits from having this intelligence of the internet coming to us. For example, when we blogged the speaker just a few weeks after, Will.i.am decided to have it in his music video, and they made a 3D model of it.
That's a pretty good endorsement.
Yeah, Will.i.am and Britney Spears, they have 282 million views on that video now. That's 2 times the Super Bowl ad, and we're there for 3 seconds. But imagine that exposure.
Yeah.
So, you know, turn that around as a business model. It can work for you as well to be sort of open dialogue. And I mean, certainly we'd continued in that line when we put it on Kickstarter. It's when you basically put your idea on the internet and people get to fund it. Hundreds of people pledged hundreds of dollars to make this product happen. And they've been kind of part of our development team as well. I mean, when we have production problems, people reach out to us and give us feedback and like, maybe you can do it this way. And so it's a really great way to test your product on the market as well.
Just very briefly then, you are in London. It's the London Design Festival. Tell me about your presence here. Are you exhibiting?
Yes, we are. We are doing a Represent Showroom fashion show. It's a Swedish design and fashion collective. So we thought, like, because this product isn't like your normal consumer tech thing where you're talking just about technology, it's more about your lifestyle. Where better to put it than with the leading fashion brands from Sweden? So, yeah, we're really proud to share the showroom with Robert Geer and Dagmar and a bunch of people who's really coming up from Sweden. And it's fun because everyone there loves the speaker as well. So it's not just a typical male, you know, product. It's something that will actually work when couples move together in the city. So it's a kind of proof of concept for us. And at the same time, we want to find retailers in London. So it's a great way to sort of show them the product. And if you can play loudly around the catwalk, you can probably, you know, manage in your living room as well.
That was Martin Willers from the Swedish industrial design agency People People with Monocle's Aled John. It is time now for a bit of music. Let's stay on that track and in Sweden. This is I Break Horses with the song Wired. That was I Break Horses with the song Wired. You are listening to Aperitivo and we are fast approaching the end of the program. Before we go, let's preview the rest of the day's programming here on Monocle 24. I am joined now by Thomas Lewis, the producer of this evening's edition of Globalist Asia. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you very much for having me.
Tom,
yes, how are you?
I'm very good. How are you yourself? Have you listened to the program upstairs?
I have been following it upstairs, and it's been an absolute corker of a show, even if I do say.
Well, what I've heard is that tonight's edition of the Globalist Asia is going to be something quite unique.
Well, you know, we never like to disappoint when the Globalist Asia is concerned, and hopefully tonight will be no exception. So we're leading with this story coming out of Afghanistan, Marcus. It's believed to be the highest ranking civilian defection from the political establishment in Afghanistan to the Taliban. It's a former senator and a former governor of a region in the north of Afghanistan, Qazi Abdul Hai. He's believed to have defected with two of his bodyguards on Tuesday. A video has emerged on a Taliban website where he gave a statement for his motives for leaving the government. He claimed that there was a lot of corruption that he'd seen, and he felt that that was a betrayal of the Afghan people. He also said, and it's quite a powerful quote that's been translated quite widely, "Our villages were bombarded and our houses were searched by the invaders." Now, this is tapping in, obviously, to the occupation by the US and allied forces, who are going to withdraw next year. And there are big nationwide elections next year in Afghanistan too. So actually, this politician is not believed to be in Afghanistan at the moment. He's believed to be in Pakistan. So that's kind of an interesting dynamic, whether this is a statement gesture or what else is behind it, really.
Definitely, there's a lot to talk about, and that's the story that's going to start in today's edition of The Globalist Asia. What else do you have lined up?
So we always like to bring you a bit of light relief, and I think we have a bit of sound that maybe we can play for you now, Marcus. Maybe you could give your response to this. So many youthful memories for me there with my first ever Game Boy, which was maybe one of the best presents I'd ever been given, I think, at the time.
I was a Commodore 64 kid, so I missed that.
Showing your age maybe there, Marcus. But yes, the reason we played that for you is the former president of Nintendo, Hiroshi Yamauchi. He passed away aged 85 today. He was president of Nintendo from 1949 to 2002, which is pretty extraordinary tenure for anyone in any job, really.
And absolutely amazing career. I still remember Nintendo. I was sometimes allowed to go and see my friends and play a bit of games, and that's how I discovered Tetris.
And you think back to the sort of the 80s or the early 90s, and Nintendo really was the game. You know, this we see every Christmas some queue for some product or another outside stores around the world. And Nintendo, in a way, I think, was kind of the first sort of benchmark toy to really sort of bring the hordes out.
You have no idea how many Christmas I wanted to get a Nintendo as a present, but it never happened.
Oh, Marcus.
I blame the Santa Claus.
What a hole in the childhood memories there.
It may have been about my parents' philosophy as well on what I should do when I'm having my time off from school.
Well, if you tune in later, hopefully that will fill some of the void for you, Marcus.
It sounds like a good show coming up tonight on The Globalist Asia. Do you want to mention one more topic, possibly?
Well, we'll obviously be checking in with one of our correspondents around the world. We'll be checking with Amber Phillips later. She is our woman in Washington, D.C. It's been quite a big week for Washington. Obviously, a very serious shooting incident there at the Navy Yard. She'll bring us the latest on that. Also, we'll be bringing you the latest business headlines from Asia, which we always like to do on The Globalist Asia. And just we've got a couple of surprises up our sleeve too, Marcus. So I think that's as good a reason as any to tune in at 2000 hours London time.
You know, I just remember that I am involved in that programme as
you
well.
You are. You were keeping that very quiet. You're a modest man, Marcus Hippie.
Indeed, Globalist Asia at 2000 hours.
100 hours
London time.
We're getting confused with
this time zones. Thank you, Thomas Lewis, producer of that programme. And that is all we have time for on today's Aperitivo. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Shashank Joshi from Russia and Brett Mason, Europe correspondent for SBS World News Australia. We talked about how world leaders use and misuse the media. Next after the headlines is The Urbanist, and with Andrew Tuck. And this week the team is taking a look at friendly cities, whether they are bike-friendly, eco-friendly, or are just trying to adopt a warm and welcoming appearance. We are finding out just how easy it is to tack on friendly to a city's brand.
Friendliness, as you're pointing out, is quite an intangible and almost a cultural concept. What friendliness means in a Western context could be really different for an African. African friendliness is quite expressive and demonstrative, as opposed to the concept I think we're describing here, which is much more of a functional one. I think when we say bike friendly, we mean it works for bikes. We're not talking about an emotional notion of friendliness. We're talking about that it works for bikes, it works well for kids, it works well for talent. So I think that's the first thing to do.
That was The Urbanist in just a few minutes. And then 2000 hours London time, it's time for The Globalist Asia. And then at 2200 hours, The Monocle Daily airs with me and Andrew Müller. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Aperitivo, it is goodbye. Thank you for listening.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise,
and the passion of skilled watchmakers all add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.